Thanks, John. I'm Jimmy Thomas over alcohol. I'm extremely grateful to be here. Well, Woodstock, I've only been there about 10 years. Before there, I lived in New York. I was born and raised in upstate New York, Syracuse, New York. And I remember when I moved down here, I heard that it's quite common for us Yankees, you know, where they say as soon as a Yankee crosses the Mason-Dixon line, he pulls in the first service station and asks what part of Florida he's in. But I'm glad I was never that naive. But it sure is, it makes me proud to know that I've been asked to speak here tonight at the Common Sense Group, right here in the heart of Miami Beach, Florida. It may not be there, but I can sure wish. No, this is great. And this mountain country, my God, this mountain air is wonderful, except, boy, it makes you thirsty. But not that kind of thirsty. I really enjoyed the trip. We left about 1 o'clock this afternoon. And about an hour or two ago, before we just came on our way down here, I said, you know, this proves to me one thing. Claude says, what's that? And I says, it proves to me that the earth is round, because if it wasn't, we'd have fell off a long time ago. But it got us here, perseverance, and I'm sure grateful to be here. I mentioned that I'm powerless over alcohol. And believe me, let me tell you something, my friends. Being powerless is an understanding that I sure didn't have before I came in this program. I didn't understand what alcoholism was. I didn't know what an excessive drinker was. And that I'm eternally grateful to be here. You know, I found out there's three areas of gratitude that are so important to my sobriety. Three areas. And because I remember many times before I came to this AA program, along the, shall we say, the termination of my drinking, I knew I had a problem. I knew alcohol now was really probably the seat of all my problems. I'm beginning to understand that what used to deny it, but now I'm beginning to realize that this drunkenness, this constant being drunk and drinking, is just causing a lot of hell and havoc in my life. So I tried to quit, and really, you know, that was the term I used. I said, I'll quit. But, you know, after a few days of not drinking, I'd say, well, you know, Jim, you've been pretty good to yourself. You owe yourself a drink or two. And I would drink again. Or sometimes I would say, you know, I'm going out tonight, but I'm just going to have orange juice or something. I'm not going to drink tonight. Before the night was over, I'd be half-bombed again. Or many, many times, I'm just going to have one. I'm just going to have one drink, and that's it. And walk away. But I had one drink. I didn't understand that powerful compulsion of alcoholism, that mental obsession, that physical compulsion that demanded and commanded that I have more than one drink. And I used to say, you know, that if I ever left a saloon before it closed, it wasn't because I wanted to. They usually had to back up a tow truck and get me out. I think the two most sorriest words I used to hear when I was drinking was when a bartender would holler out, last call. So, man. That was brutal. And understanding, when I first came in this AA program, you know, I looked around at all the people in the rooms and whatever, and I'm saying, how are you people going to stop me from drinking? I mean, even though I wanted to, because I wanted to before, or so I thought, you see. How are you going to stop? I looked around, I didn't see any medical equipment here. I didn't see any, what's going to make me stop? I couldn't do it, and then I heard we just talk. How are people going to talk me out of drinking? You see, that's the being so naive about what AA is all about. And when sometimes a person, you're trying to make someone understand, like even when you're making amends, you know, that, well, you don't, they don't understand what you're coming from. I had so many people who used to tell me, if that alcohol is raising so much hell in your life, why don't you quit? You know, why don't you just quit? You can go out, you don't have to have one. Huh. But see, they don't understand. And even then, I didn't understand. And I came to understand that powerlessness to me was, the powerlessness was the fact that I couldn't drink one drink and predict the outcome. I mean, I couldn't take one drink and tell you, well, that's it. I don't want no more. I couldn't take one drink and tell you I would behave. I couldn't take one drink and tell you I wouldn't go to sleep. I couldn't take one drink and predict anything because the drink took over my system. And so I'm so grateful, my friend, so grateful in the first area that I realize I'm powerless over the first drink. You know, if I didn't understand I was powerless, I would probably still think in some situation, good, bad, or otherwise, that a drink might help me or be good for me. But I understand I'm powerless over that first drink. I cannot take one drink successfully. And so now, then the second area of gratitude is that we have meetings such as this, that no matter how good I feel, I can improve upon it. No matter how sober I am, I can improve upon that. Or no matter how maybe down and out and shaky I might feel, I can come here and improve upon my sobriety. That there's meetings for this, that there is a solution. Knowing that I'm powerless is great. And now knowing there's a solution, wow, that makes it even greater. But I promise you this, it may not be so in your life. I can only speak about myself, my God, and my program. But you take those two areas of gratitude. Number one, realizing I'm powerful. Number two, realizing that there is a program I can go to and improve upon my sobriety. Those two may not be enough. Just may not be enough without this third area. This third area of gratitude. And Bill said it before he started to read. I have a firm desire on a daily basis to come to these meetings and to improve upon what I have. Can you imagine coming to these rooms and not having a desire to stop drinking? Understanding your powers, understanding that there's a program, but have no desire to stop drinking. You know, and when a first alcoholic first comes in these rooms, we understand that. I came here of my own volition. I finally was ready to throw in the towel. I didn't know what I had to do, but maybe I was willing to try it. But I didn't come in here with a desire to stop. I just knew that I should. And I talked to a couple people, husband and wife, through over the last 6 or 7 years have been trying to quit smoking. And they would go a few months together. Next thing you know, one or the other would be back smoking. Then they might go another few months back smoking. And I said, well, why are you trying to stop? Well, Jimmy, you see the ads and the medical reports. It's not good for you. You know, it's not good for you, so we're trying to quit. And then I said, well, then you feel as though you're trying to stop smoking because you should, because it's bad for your health. Well, yeah. And I said, well, you'll probably continue to have trouble stopping smoking until you create a desire, until you want to stop for yourself. Not because it's bad for you, but because you want to stop. You see, not because you should, but because you want to. And that's the same way in that third tradition that says the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. A desire. That's the only requirement. And come into these rooms, meeting after meeting after meeting after meeting, and sitting here knowing I should be in here but wishing I was out there in the saloons. What a horrible feeling that is. You know what that is? There's the horror of drinking for an alcoholic, and that's the horror of not drinking. The horror of not drinking. Sitting in these rooms wishing you were out there, wishing you could drink again, and knowing that you can but you won't. And boy, I'm telling you, and that's being double-minded. You know, it's like being in the saloon knowing you should be in AA. And a double-minded person, my friends, will never be content. Never be content. And that's double-mindedness. Knowing I should be doing something and wishing I should be doing something else. And that will never be a contentment. That's why we find in these AA rooms that after sometimes months, years, people haven't had a drink a day at a time, but are still suffering mentally and emotionally. And haven't really conjured up a desire to stop, but just in here because they know they should or shouldn't, or because their sponsor took them by the ear and dropped them off at a meeting or whatever, or the court ordered. And this is what's important, but at least they're here. I mean, that is something. But to be grateful, you see, gratitude is a cornerstone of anyone's sobriety, to be a powerful cornerstone. To be grateful that there's a program like this, to be grateful I understand that I have this illness, and to be so powerfully grateful that on a daily basis I have a desire not to drink and to improve upon my sobriety. And that's gratitude, my friends. Let me say this. I don't think I will ever see a grateful alcoholic drink, or a drinking alcoholic that's grateful. You see how powerful gratitude is. It's so powerful. And here's another thing. I don't care who comes into these rooms and what they have or don't have, what they lost or think they have lost. If I came in here crawling on my belly from sleeping out in them weeds for months, and let's say I had a thin dime in my pocket and that's all I own. Instead of cursing my existence at that present time, I should bless myself. Take out that dime. Look at that dime and bless it and say, my God, I got to start. I got a beginning. You know why? I'll tell you why. Gratitude, my friends, and listen to this, in all areas of life, gratitude is a launching pad for increase. You see, there can be no increase without first gratitude. If I'm not grateful for what I have, do I deserve anything more? If I'm not grateful for what I have, how will I get anything more? If I'm not grateful for what I have, I will probably lose what I have. Gratitude, the launching pad for increase, and this is a program of increase. This is a spiritual program, And why does it work spiritually? Simply because of this. Anyone who comes in here and puts down a drink a day at a time, that's all they've done. That's all they've done is not drink one day at a time. You see, that same person without a drink, that same person, meaning that same mind, will always want to drink again. That same person without a drink will never be comfortable without a drink. That same person will never be comfortable in these rooms and will probably drink again. We must take on a new and different mind. This program calls for one thing only after we put down the drink a day at a time. Just one thing only. Two words, spiritual progress. That's all. You don't have to run 10 miles a day to stay sober. Now, it might help you feel better, really. You don't have to chop 2-quarter wood a day. Now, it might help keep your house warm. But you don't have to do that to stay sober. You don't have to wash the dishes at night to stay sober. It might help in the family, take a little pressure off, but you don't have to do that to stay sober. The only thing you have to do, my friends, is engender into the spiritual aspect of AA. Spiritual aspect, because listen, my friends, here's the reason why. Very simply, the mind that created all our problems in life, is not smart enough to solve them. It's not smart enough to solve them, or it wouldn't have created them in the first place. It takes a new and different mind. You see, from the human, carnal, alcoholic mind, which will continue to create the same problems, so we must obtain a new and different mind. My God says, lest you be born again in thought. We must obsess ourselves with the spiritual mind. See, the spiritual mind lifts us above. All the problems, all the headaches, all the heartaches, all the hangovers, all the lonely days, all the lonely nights, all the wasted days, all the wasted nights. It's not on the spiritual plane, but it's down there on the alcoholic mind, the alcoholic plane. That's why we must obtain the spiritual aspect of AA. And not knowing I'm powerless over alcohol. My God, wouldn't that be something? So I walked into a meeting this afternoon to meet my friends that were going to drive me down here, make sure I got here. There's only 5 or 6 of them. We're getting more sober. There were 6 of us in 3 cars, I think. And we're planning, if we ever come down again, how we can fit 6 into 2 cars. Well, it's a little more economical, don't you think? But, you know, that comes with long-term sobriety.
Keep coming back, Jimmy.
The mind that creates the problems, and that's matter of the soul. So we must obtain a spiritual mind. Now, to understand the fact that when I first came in here, I didn't know what an alcoholic was. But anyway, I was walking into this meeting, and that's where we met before we left. And as I walked in, there was a woman talking. And boy, they can talk. And she was relating about, you know, her experiences when she came in, and she says she didn't think she was alcoholic because she couldn't identify with maybe drinking in the morning, or she never slept in the weeds. I mean, I've heard it. I've been to many, many meetings over a course of years, and I've heard many people have gone back out and come back in and said, I didn't think I was alcoholic because I never bought a bottle out of the liquor store. I never did myself. Or I never slept in the weeds. Or I never slept under the bridge. Or I never went to jail. Or somebody else will say, I didn't think I was alcoholic. I never got a DUI. So what they're trying to do is relate to what they think an alcoholic is. And I say this, In fact, I opened the meeting by saying, I'm Jimmy, powerless over alcohol. Powerless over alcohol. Now, see, alcoholism is what they named it. That's what they named this illness, alcoholism. Now, they could have named it beerism. They could have named it wineism. They could have named it liquorism. Maybe talking about Wayne then. They could have named it drunkenism. But they didn't. They chose to name it alcoholism, see. So, alcoholism, what we do in here to find a solution to any problem, we try to find the exact nature. Alcoholism is the title. The exact nature of alcoholism is being powerless. You see, the first part of that first step, it doesn't say we admitted we were alcoholic. It doesn't. It says we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, so there can be no escape. So you can't say if you go back out and come back in, or whatever, and say, well, you know, I didn't think I was alcoholic because I never got evicted from an apartment. I never thought I was alcoholic because I used to get a paycheck and buy groceries for my family. I didn't think I was alcoholic, you know, because my watch never went to the hot shop. You see, this is what we have to understand. It isn't what my idea of an alcoholic is. It's whether I'm powerless or not. Now, we can relate to that as alcoholics. I cannot take one drink safely. I cannot take one drink and predict the outcome. Listen to this. I drink for effect and no other reason. Effect and no other reason. Many, many years ago up in New York before I got sober, I was still drinking. A friend of mine called me on a Sunday afternoon during the football season. Jimmy, come on over. We're watching a football game. Joe's coming over and he's bringing a six-pack, you know. In the alcoholic mind immediately, Pete, Joe, and me, a six-pack. Well, I didn't go. Would you have gone? No. No. You see, we drink for effect. We drink for the effect. And if there ain't nothing there, it's just a tease. It's just a tease. I used to say the way they got me to this AA program is they tied a can of beer on a stick and led me in. But I'll tell you one thing, that would have worked. And I bet you would have worked for any one of you. You know it would have. We'd have chased that. So this is what's important. It isn't the fact that I'm talking to anybody saying, don't say you're alcoholic. I'm Jimmy, I'm alcoholic. I'm alcoholic. But understand the meaning and the purpose of what an alcoholic is. An alcoholic is someone who is powerless over that first drink, is powerless over alcohol. And that's what's important. Now a person can't come in and say to me, well, I didn't think I was alcoholic. You knew you were powerless. Well, yes, you knew you drank for effect because I told you that. You agreed to me. You knew that one drink wasn't enough. And if one was too many and 1,000 was too much, not enough. But you knew that. I knew it. And when I had this stuff explained to me, I began to realize that's what powerlessness means. And we admit we're powerless. You don't have to sweep in the weeds with a trench coat and a wine bottle. You don't have to, kind of if you want. Alcohol will put you there sooner or later. But what I'm trying to say is don't try to identify, because that's what a lot of people do coming into the program, try to identify with what they hear around the rooms. Well, I never went to jail. I heard this guy, and this guy got a DUI. That never happened to me. I'm still running a business, a guy told me. Yeah. So this is what we have to understand, powerless over alcohol. And this became important to me when I was sponsoring people, especially new people, to make them understand what the exact nature of this problem is. And remember this, my friends, this is so important. In the beginning, there can be no healing. This is an illness. And there can be no healing, no healing, until first we admit to the illness. We must admit we're powerless. Because let me tell you this, next week, sometime next week, I'll have 24 years without a drink, 24 years. But if at any time, any given time, good, bad, or otherwise, I thought I could take a drink, just have one, my friends, I'd be back out there. And it isn't that Jimmy drank, Jimmy took a drink, it's that Jimmy's drinking again. You see, I must believe that. So this is why we must admit first that we are powerless. We must admit to this illness or we cannot be healed. We're only fooling ourselves. It'll only be a little while later, because sooner or later, my friends, that alcoholic mind will say, it's okay to have one. That alcoholic mind will tell you that. It's okay to have a drink. Isn't this great to understand that I'm powerless over alcohol and that I'm so eternally grateful, for my God and people in this program? It's just incredible. And I didn't drink until I was 19 years old. You see, I was a youngster in high school, and I didn't like school, and I didn't want to go to work. Now, that's a confused kid. And I said to a guy once, I says, you know, I said, I was 3 years in high school, and I says, I think I'm going to quit. And he says to me, well, Jimmy, that wouldn't be a very good idea. And I says, why not? And he says, well, he says, 3 years in high school, next year you're a senior, you graduate. And I says, no, I'm 3 years in high school, and I'm still a freshman. And he says, oh, that would be a good idea. Why don't you quit? So I quit. But very briefly, I had a talent. I started boxing, amateur, and I was pretty good, and I won the Golden Gloves just before I quit school. And I was quite a light heavyweight amateur champion up in Central New York and Canada and Pennsylvania. And I was winning a lot of fights, and I was making a little name for myself. And then I turned professional. And when I turned pro was when I started drinking, and I started off fairly good. And then because of the alcohol, I started losing the people I knew I could beat or figured I could beat. You know, alcohol just, it became a brand new desire to become a good athlete. All of a sudden, I just wanted to stay in the saloons and whatever, and miss that road work, and my timing got bad, and whatever, win some or lose some. But then I got involved with underworld figures because I thought I'd be a big asset. You know, they hung around the gymnasiums, and here's a big tall guy and some kind of a boxing champion, and they lay out a lot of money, and they need people to go out and collect, you know, pick it up. And nothing wrong with that. I didn't have to fill out an application, so I went along with it, see? And this was organized crime and whatever. None of this I could deny, but I ended up, I started reaping the rewards of that way of living, and that way of thinking, I should say. And I got a 1 year in the local penitentiary. Over the years, I got charged in Chautauqua County down below Buffalo with safe cracking, and that's when you take money out of a safe that don't belong to you. And it was right across the highway from the state police barracks, and they really frowned on that because it makes them look bad. And I got 5 years probation, and a year or so later, I got charged with trying to relieve a jewelry store of its valuables, and then I got a violation of probation. I didn't get indicted, so I did the probation a year, and I come out, and I was free again. And in 61, I got married, and I had to leave town, Syracuse, on my honeymoon because the grand jury was sitting on these flim-flam scores, as they call them, confidence scores. And I got extradited on my honeymoon from Baltimore, Maryland, and don't make for a good start of a wedding. And but I told her I wasn't 9 to 5, and she was beginning to believe it. And I made bail, and in the meantime went to trial, and it was a very celebrated trial up there. And I got acquitted at trial, and of course they, now I'm a big man in the underworld. You know, I was getting my own. Gee, this guy Jimmy, yeah, he's going places and whatever. And keep on going. You know, everything, what I was really doing, I didn't understand, is because I was pursuing alcohol. I was pursuing the drink and didn't know that's what I was really doing. And this way of living was, well, I wasn't going to work. They used to tell me that drink is the curse of the working man. Well, for me, work would have been curse of the drinking man. I wasn't going to work. And this way I was making money off other people. You know, you go to work all week and now I'll get paid at the end of the week when I follow you home. And this was better for me, and I didn't really need a high school education for all this. And this is what was happening in my life, and the more I drank and the more I lusted for more money and whatever. I got really involved with underworld figures, and I got indicted with them. I mean, like I say, these things I can't deny. But when I got extradited on my honeymoon and went to trial on these confidence scores, and this was a celebrated trial up there in New York, and I got acquitted, and once again, this guy, wow, he's really going to places and whatever. You know, in 1964, this is just in 1 year, I got indicted. I was mentioned down in Chautauqua County below Buffalo on 9 counts of forgery, and the state's attorney jumps in and he says, you know, this guy isn't writing checks or passing them, but he's heading a statewide forgery ring, and it's netting quite a few thousands of dollars a year, and we've got to put a stop to this guy, see. So I made bail and went back into the saloons, and I got indicted again in 1964 on 54 counts of forgery in Onondaga County. That's where I live. And I made bail, went back into the saloons, I got indicted in 1964 on accessory to robbery in the first degree. And I made bail, went back into the saloons, and I got indicted again in 1964 on robbery in the first degree. And now the bail bondsman was beginning to think I was becoming a risk. And people kind of backed off me, and they lodged me in this new public safety building. And in the summer of 1964, I got indicted by the federal government on a $450,000 postal money order swindle. With the, there was a Utica mob up there, Underworld Figures, infamous mob, they were indicted with me. And now they weren't talking about any bail. And but in the long run, I went to trial eventually on the robbery one. It was almost a year before I went to trial because of all pretrial motions and whatever, and witnesses and all that nonsense. And anyway, the maximum was 60 years. As a second offender, and I had that safe conviction, which made me a second offender, and the judge of the court had already designated me as a one-man crime wave with organized crime ties. So I was going to get 60, especially if I went to trial. Well, we did go to trial, and I often remember this. I had a good criminal lawyer named Frank, who, by the way, he was just a handsome man. He was a courtroom the people crammed the courtrooms to watch him try cases. He was an unbelievable criminal defense lawyer, and he had showmanship and whatever, and he used to take his glasses when he was summing up my case, you know, one of my cases, I don't know which one it was, but he'd be banging them glasses on the defense table right in front of the jury, you know. And then he'd come back and sit down, and I says, "Frank, you're going to break the glass." And he piles them up, there ain't no glass in there, see. He was just a showman, and he'd take that water pitcher in the glass, you know, like the bartenders used to, and that water was coming out. And he always had fascinated the jury, and kept getting me acquitted. And but this time something went wrong, because when the jury come out, we looked at the jury, and you can tell a jury, this was long before the OJ case. I mean, we knew juries then when they come out. And when the men look at the ceiling, they look at the floor, they won't look at you. And the women, for some reason, dabbing their eyes with a handkerchief. Why do they do that? And my lawyer leans over and he says, "We're dead." And I thought of that big 60 years. And I says, "What do you mean we, Frank? You know, I'm dead." And sure enough, they found me guilty and whatever. But this didn't bother me. I had a problem in life that I could do time. I didn't want to do it, but I could do it. I mean, it was no big thing to me. Nobody wanted to do time, but I mean, I didn't do no hard time. And but when I was in the county jail and I were waiting sentencing and we're making motions against the first conviction and this one and whatever, constitutionality of this and that, I'm going on almost another year waiting for sentencing. And in the meantime, I'm a good guy in the county jail, you know. Give this guy some cigarettes and I help people write letters. You know, most people in prison can't express themselves. That's one reason they're in there. You know, they go into outbursts because they feel they just can't express themselves. So I'd write letters. I'm a high school dropout, but I could express myself. And I would help them write letters to their lawyers and their family. I was an all-around good guy. And not once thinking of taking off any scores, you know, and whatever. So actually my mind was changed. And see, it was a cosmic law. There's a spiritual law. So when we engender into spirituality, first it's nice to know what it is, what it's all about. Is it just trying to be good every day? You know, pet the dog and be nice to the family and go to work? I mean, that's not spirituality. You know, we hope it is, but it's not. It's more than that. It's deeper than that, but it's not difficult. It's easier to learn than trigonometry. That's why I quit school. It's easier to learn than algebra. It's easier to learn to be an architect. It's easier to learn than to be an airplane pilot. It's easier to learn than, I think, than driving a car. Spirituality, spiritual concept of this program is so simple because it's of God. It's of God. And anything of God is easy. There's nothing difficult about it. You don't have to be a high school graduate to understand God, how God wants us to live this life. So there's a cosmic or spiritual law that can't be broken. I do this a lot at a meeting. take my handkerchief and drop it. We all know it's going to fall. I'm going to do it again. Watch. It fell twice in a row. I'm going to do it again. Three times. And I say, I don't suggest anyone try this at home. We don't want nobody to get hurt. But there's four times in a row. And we know that every time I drop it, because it's the law of gravity. You know, that's a spiritual law, cosmic law, the law of gravity. Nobody thinks it wouldn't. And if it stayed up there, Jimmy's a magician. He knows something we don't. I'm on the talk shows and whatever, you know, because my handkerchief didn't come down. So that's the cosmic spiritual law. It has to happen. It has to happen. It can't be diluted. There's nothing that's going to come down, that handkerchief, every time I let it go. How could we have been, or how could I have been, so ignorant of these spiritual laws of my life? The simplest law that our God says, like begets like. There's nothing simpler than that. But it's a cosmic spiritual law, and if I follow it, I can be very successful in this life. Like begets like is simply that a farmer plants corn and grows cotton. It can't happen. He's going to be on the talk show. You see, the harvest must be of the seed. I'm talking sobriety now, my friends. This is sobriety. You know what sobriety is to me? I don't know what it is to you, but to me it's not drinking a day at a time. It's just not drinking. It's not drinking a day at a time in absence of inner turmoil. Absence of inner turmoil. Cool, man. Relax. I rode down with them two thugs all the way down. Never once got upset. And I got to go back. I never thought of that. I got to get back with it. Wow. Let me tell you something. Life begets life. So the farmer plants cotton. The harvest must be of the seed. In everything in this life, the harvest must be of the seed. Now, here's the first spiritual concept. That if you understand this, and it's so simple, start changing your whole life right now. The harvest must be of the seed. Like begets like. If I plant corn, the harvest must be corn. If I plant cotton, the harvest must be cotton. If I plant poor thoughts, the harvest must be poor experiences. If I harvest good thoughts, if I plant good thoughts, the harvest must be good experiences. This is the cosmic spiritual law. Handed down by our Creator, or mine. It cannot be obviated. It cannot be diluted. In no way can it be taken away. It's every moment of every day, every thought I have in my mind has a reaction, a spiritual cosmic reaction, you see, because I've seen so many in these rooms, and I've felt for them, that haven't had a drink in a long, long, long time, but man, don't cross them. They blow up, they scream, don't get in the car with them and have somebody cut them off. This is not sobriety to me, this is just not drinking. I'm only speaking for myself. I'm only speaking about myself and my God and my program. The harvest must be of the seed. I cannot change my life. I cannot change my life until first I change my thinking. There's no other way. If there was any other way, then I would be a victim of circumstances out there. Be like placing a child out on the highway to fend for himself. I remember when I used to wake up years and years ago before I come to program, and the fellow said to me, Jimmy, you want to have a good day? And I'd say, I don't know. I got to see what happens. If good things happen, I'll have a good day. If poor things happen, I'll probably have a poor day. You see, I was a victim of circumstances and a victim of life. I was a victim of every day because not every day was to my liking. And therefore I had bad days. Not understanding that my God created me and put me in this world and gave me dominion over it. Dominion over this earth. Simply by the way I think. Simply by the way I think. So if I can learn to think, this is sober thinking, you see. Sobriety, absence of inner turmoil, cannot be unless I understand how to think, because that's all it is. Changing our thinking. Doesn't the big book say there must be a psychic change? There must be a psychic change. And this is what we're talking about. We're not talking about still gritting our teeth and saying, well, I didn't drink. I've come to meetings and so have you. possibly. And seeing people pound their fist on the table and say, I'm so angry today I almost drank. I'm so angry today I almost ran my car into a telephone pole. I'm so angry today I think I'm going insane. And many, 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 like I first did when I first came in, thinking, well, that's natural. If somebody bothered you or offended you, it just happens natural to get angry. I used to think it was natural if somebody's talking to me to get resentful to me. I would get resentful of that person. It's the natural thing to do. It's the natural thing to do is to get resentful if somebody's talking about you. This AA program and my spiritual growth has taught me this, that it is not natural. If it was natural, I'd feel real good. I wouldn't be pounding my fist saying I almost took a drink today if it was a natural reaction. You see, natural means nature. I'm created in God's nature, aren't you? And God is good and all good. It's unnatural, or we would feel good about being angry. Hell, we can say, boy, I felt really angry today. Well, good, boy, that's keeping you away from a drink. But this guy over here is joyous, and I'm worried about him. You see what I'm saying? If I'm creating God's image, then it's wrong for me. It's unnatural to be angry. This is how far man has fallen from God, to believe it's a natural thing, to believe it's natural. So it's not natural to be angry. It's not natural. It's natural. You see, my God says this. Listen to this, my friends. And every day, I can be a victor or I can be a victim. And today I'm a victor. Every day. No, I'm a victor because I've learned one thing. The supreme art of living. I've learned this in my survival. The supreme art of living. You know what that is? It's very simple. It's very simple. Right reaction. Right reaction is how I react to what goes on about me. You see, it used to be that what goes on about me was more important than what goes on inside me. No longer. Today, in my spiritual content, what's inside me is more important than what goes on about me. In other words, as I grow spiritually, as I become spiritually fulfilled and have what I call spiritual embodiment, right inside me right now, you can't see it, but I can feel it. You can't see it, but I can feel it. There's a little pilot light going on in there. A nice warm glow that's consistently going. And I don't care what happens to me outside me. Any traumatic situation, any desperate situation. It doesn't mean that I don't have responsibilities, and it doesn't mean that I ignore them. I try my best to take care of my responsibilities. But no matter what happens, that warm glow of confidence is constantly going inside me. Because now I'm acting in my God's nature. Did you know that? I'm acting in concert with my higher power. I have harmony with my higher power. Take a potted plant and put it in the window. Put it in the window. If it's decent week or so, month or so, you know, we get a good share of sunshine, all of a sudden you'll see it lean right toward the sun. You see it leans towards Creator. Before its Creator. Anything living separated from its Creator sooner or later will wither or die. And that's why we were so lost. Lost souls, drinking, walking in darkness. You know, the quickest way, the quickest, instant, most desperate, I can break my bond with my God as an alcoholic is to take one drink. As soon as I take a drink, I become an anti-Christ. I do. I don't know about you, but I do. Now, anything bereft, which say in a sense separated from its Creator, sooner or later will wither and die. And we see many alcoholics, many problem drinkers, people like ourselves and even ourselves, if we can remember that when we were separated from our Creator, we had nothing but problems, static in our lives. If we didn't, I don't think any of us would be in here right now. You see, as soon as I separate myself from my God, I'm walking in darkness. And I'm creating static in my life. And so I must understand that I'm in nature with God. Nature. You see, that becomes natural then. Then to get angry, to get upset, is unnatural. I cannot, and I, Scouts Honor, I was in for 9 days. I couldn't learn my knots. I forget where I was. But anyway, we must grow spiritually. You see, this is our connection, this is our bond, and this is separates us from the drink, further and further from the drink. There's two planes. I'm down on the human plane, the mental plane, the alcoholic plane, which is the alcoholic thinking. And down on that plane is the thought and the desire to drink. It's down there constantly, and it's tempting me. And and down there is the wrong reaction, right? Anger, resentment, pity, guilt. It's down there, see? As I grow spiritually, I'm lifted above that plane. I'm lifted above it. So right now, I'm on a plane right now where if anything traumatic, anything whatever happens in my life, the thought of a drink doesn't come to me at all. It isn't there. It isn't on this plane. Oh, I started to say, I can't remember, and I'm talking in terms of years and years and years, when I argued with anybody. I mean, seriously argued with somebody. I'm not a doormat. I have discussions, I have disagreements, but to argue, you know, like two people, they scream at each other, the one that screams the loudest or says the most filthy words is supposed to win the argument, I guess, you know, and yet you get two dogs out there fighting and they pour cold water on them. They should pour cold water on these people when they're screaming and howling at one another. And now I will never again be drawn into it. And it isn't so much that I have to be on guard, it's that in the spiritual content, it doesn't enter into it. You don't have that desire. You see, desires change. The desires that I used to think, or my wants, that I used to think that I, well, you know, you've heard so many people with character defects, they'll say, well, you know, I'm hanging on to a few of them. I don't want to be perfect, you know, and there's a few I ain't going to give up. And whatever, but let me tell you something. As you grow spiritually, you don't want them. We outgrow them like a child outgrows his little fire engine, or a little girl outgrows her doll that she wants to go to sleep with every night. You take that doll from that kid and they won't go to sleep, they'll cry all night. But 20 years later, they can't imagine they acted that way. And this is the same way as you get sober. These alcoholic thoughts and desires leave. And all of a sudden they look ridiculous and they look contemptuous to a sober mind. And that's how you don't return to them. But when I said that the thought of a drink never enters my mind, the desire to drink, what I'm telling you this, my friends, is that as long as I keep coming to these meetings and listening to you people and reading my big book and reaching out to others, I must maintain that. But if I stop meetings, and I stop communing with you people and stop reading my big book and whatever, what's going to happen is that sooner I'll go back down to that plane to where all of a sudden I'll be arguing with people again. Or maybe I'll be thinking about taking a drink. You see, this is what I mean. I must stay on the plane that I'm on the spiritual plane. I really must. And it's so important. It's so important. But I've heard so many people say to me, you know, Jimmy, what you're saying is, but how, you know, when a person, say, has been angry all their life, I heard a guy say he has a short fuse. He has a short fuse. I remember after a meeting once a woman come to me. Now listen to this. Here's the clues. These are the clues. And tell you just how simple all this is. A woman come to me and she says, you know, Jimmy, I wish I had your patience. And I says, you wish you had my patience. And then she says, yeah. I says, well, right now, we're both nice and calm and peaceful, right? She says, yeah. I says, you already have my patience. She says, no, I don't. I short fuse it. And I says, let me tell you something. Right now, you have the same as I have. But if something, like once again, traumatic happens or negative happens, see, I'll retain my patience, but you will surrender yours to take on a negative response. I won't do that, but you will. It doesn't mean you don't have my patience. It means that you will not covet it in the face of the enemy, which is anything negative. You will surrender it and take on an aggressive or whatever. I won't do that. You see, if God gave me more patience than her, it wouldn't be a fair God. We all have the same right now, right in this room. Nobody has any more, nobody has any less. When I'm talking about inner joy, inner peace, it's already in there. It's like the old Prego spaghetti ad car commercial. Remember, Mama made the sauce all these years, Italian Mama. Now one day she comes home, and the husband and the sons, they're all putting something in the sauce pot. She says, what are you doing? She said, we're making a sauce. Ragu, I guess it was. She says, no, it won't be. No. She says, where's the oregano? Oh, man, it's in there. Where's the garlic? It's already in there. See, it's all in the bottle. It's all in there. And we don't know. Did you ever read, these movies or read books with these supposed to be so dramatic and startling, and the search for happiness, everyone's out searching for happiness. Well, happiness wasn't hit on us, but it was put someplace where nobody would ever think it was, inside us. It's already there. We don't have to search for that. Release it. Let it out. Inner joy, inner peace is already in there. It ain't outside us. It wouldn't be fair if happiness went by on a cloud. Guys like me and Claude, we're tall. We'd reach up and grab it. We'd corner the market on happiness, and you little guys would be out of luck. I'd be overstuffed with happiness. It's already inside us. Anything God creates, He creates it with all the contents or ingredients that we already need. And here we're reading these books, 400 pages and all kinds of illustrations on how to do it. It's already inside us, everything we need to enjoy this life. But no, like that woman who wanted my patience, she just constantly would take on these negative attitudes and negative emotions and whatever, not realizing she had everything she needed already inside us. These are the great awakenings that we must need. The harvest of any thought. My God says that no thought at all, the tiniest, most minute thought in my mind will return void. That means every thought I give out will have an effect on this universe. Now, once again, I'm a high school dropout, but this guy Shakespeare, he wrote that if thou pluckest a flower, you tremble the stars. In other words, this universe is a network of thoughts. Network of thoughts. This is what makes it so fair and just. We're all in here as a result of our own thinking. And where we go when we leave here is a result of our own thinking. Unless you're kidnapped like me. This is what's important to remember. I cannot, listen to this. They will tell you that, oh, you're an alcoholic. Jimmy, you're 24 years sober, but you're only one drink away from a drunk. And that sure makes me feel very fragile if I believed, I know I'm only one drink away from a drunk, but here's where the power comes in. Here's what makes me bold in my sobriety. Here's what makes me powerful in my sobriety. I may be one drink away from a drunk, my friends, but I'm one thought from taking that drink. And as long as I'm spiritually empowered and spiritually embodied and spiritually fulfilled, that thought isn't going to come into my mind. Now, if it does yours, you better start looking up a little bit of this spiritual concept of this program. You see, I cannot do anything unless I think about it first. Does this make sense? The body is the servant of the mind. If it wasn't, there's no sense in taking people to trial. Say, my mind didn't want to do it, but my body ran away. We have to understand that the body is the servant of the mind, that I can't take a drink unless first I think about it. So what do I have to, in a sense then, protect my thinking, strengthen my thinking, and the only way I can do it is through spiritual progress, through spiritual growth. Not to be angry, not to be resentful, not to be pitiful. Guy says, well, that's impossible. It's impossible. It's impossible. I've heard this so many times. You mean to tell me that you can go 7 days without being angry? I said, I can have 7 good days in my life. The guy says, he didn't believe me. And I says, well, all you're telling me is you don't believe you could have 7 good days. Because if you believed you could, you would know that I am. And this is the truth. Well, first I must believe it. Now let me tell you this. If the God that I'm speaking about, with my cooperation, in other words, with my willingness, can take from me the strongest, most powerful, most destructive compulsion I ever had in my life, the desire to drink on a daily basis, today I don't have it at all. The thought of a drink has no desire. The thought of a drink has no attraction to me whatsoever. In fact, it's a degenerate thought, me drinking. It has no attraction to me whatsoever, the thought of a drink. The most powerful compulsion that's ruined lives, that's broken up homes, that's destroyed businesses, that's put people in hospitals and jails and prisons and penitentiaries and put them 6 feet in the ground. The most powerful compulsion has been relieved. And you think, with your willingness and cooperation with your God, that anger, resentment, pity, guilt is going to be a big thing? It is if you believe it can't be done. But I didn't believe when I come in here I would ever enjoy a day without a drink. Now I know today I could never enjoy a drink, a day with a drink. I couldn't. Do you know what that tells you? I'll tell you something else that'll help you in your sobriety. There's nothing, neither good nor bad, but what the mind makes it so. See, there's a time in my life, my friends, when the most beautiful thought I could have was swilling down a nice cold beer on a hot day. Today, it is the most disgusting thought I could have. Isn't that something? I changed my mind, and therefore I changed my life. And what used to be good is now bad. This is all we have to do, is understand. God gave this our little motor. This is our little motor, our little generator. We must take care of it. Hand me a cup of a dirty dishwasher. Dirty dishwater. The guy gives me a cup of dirty dishwater. Sets it right up here on the podium. Now while I'm talking to you, I'm sipping from it. Is that sick sucker up there telling us he's got 24 years sober and he's drinking that dirty dishwater? Is he nuts? Well, let me tell you something. It's the same way, my friends. You know, sour my stomach. But we don't talk about, we don't understand when people sour their mind with sick, dirty thoughts, contemptible thoughts, hateful thoughts, resentful thoughts, angry thoughts. What's more important? What's more precious? My mind. This is what's important. The secret place. This is where everything takes place. This is what controls my whole being. And even when I take a drink of alcohol, it souses that mind. I didn't know that. I know it now. So this is what's important, to understand the spiritual law of like begets like. The harvest must be of the seed. Perform miracles in your life. I'm running over. I got sentenced to 40 years when they convicted me on that. Robbery, I think it was, you know. And the Attica prison where that infamous riot was, and they made movies on it. And I locked right next door to Jerry Rosenberg, who they made a movie on him. He was the only inmate to get a law degree in state prison, and he represented the inmates through that infamous Attica riot where all the guards and inmates got killed. And Jerry, they made a movie, a lot of movies on it. One, Jerry made a movie on Jerry, and Tony Danza played his part in the movie. And Jerry and I were fairly close for a few years, and then they sent me down to Auburn prison. But, you know, I guess what I'm trying to say is when I got in Auburn, I started to change my life, and once again, I could do time. I didn't want to. It wasn't the 40-foot wall that bothered me that much. It wasn't the slamming of that steel door every night. That's why they call it the slammer. The concrete floor, the steel walls and ceiling, and the cold water flat. That's all you got is cold water out of there, you know. And it's, you know, and day after day after day after day after week after week after week after week after month after month after month after month after year after year after year after year. Year after year after year after year. You know, if a person don't change, there's something You know, and it isn't that this changed me. It's that I had a desire all of a sudden to become closer to my God, and because it wasn't fear of anything. That was my problem. I didn't fear nothing. But I started to change, and I started to read good books, decent books. Books about people who became successful in life. And I read this book about The Agony and the Ecstasy. It was a story of Michelangelo. It was written by Leon Uris. Irving Stone, I'm sorry. And Michelangelo, we generally know, as he painted that Sistine Chapel there. Unbelievable, beautiful Sistine Chapel, the ceiling, and he did the Last Judgment. And he was a masterful artist. But he didn't want to paint. He didn't like it at all. He loved to sculpt. He loved to carve. And he did the Pietà. He did that beautiful statue of David. And I had a friend of mine went over to Florence, Italy, and he saw that statue of David. He says, Jimmy, he come back and he says, you can't believe this statue. You can't believe the genius in this man. He says, sometimes you can maybe deflect it in a photograph or a replica. But nothing, you got to see the actual statue. It has David standing like this with a slingshot over his shoulder, and on one side where he's leaning, you can see the tenseness in his muscles in the marble. You can see tenseness in it, and you can see and feel him putting weight on that side in the marble. So it made this man a genius. And then you almost fall over, because when you look at this side, you can look at that marble and see relaxation. It's incredible. His muscles are relaxed in marble. You can sense it. The man is a genius. And when they uncovered this, when Michelangelo, when they got it in the ready for the unveiling, and the Pope who commissioned this, and all the Romans and centurions and whoever was there, I don't know, but they pulled the veil off it. People stood back because they saw and sensed the same thing as Michelangelo, what he had done. And they said to him, my God, how did you sculpt such a beautiful piece of work out of that block of marble? And he says, I didn't. And he says, you didn't? We know you did. The Pope commissioned you, and some of us saw you at times working on it. We know you did it. That ain't what I meant. He says, that statue was always inside that piece of marble. He said, all I did was chip away and chip away and chip away till I got to it. And then I polished it and refined it. And there's that beautiful piece of work. It was already in there, see? Now, my dear friends, inner joy, inner peace, happiness is some call it. Unbelievable. We're all power-packed with it. Right now, it's power-packed in there. Damn, open the package. Some people send it back to God. Address unknown or something, I don't know. It's already inside us. All we have to do, my friends, all the wonders we seek in life are already in here. They're not out there. They add to it, maybe. But here's a powerful spiritual statement, and I mean this when I say it to you right now, and I look at everybody in this room and say that I love every one of you in this room. And whether you love me back or not doesn't make no difference, because of my spiritual fulfillment, I have to love you. I have no choice. But every one of you can add to my life, but not any one of you could ever take from me. That's powerful. You can add to it, but you can't take nothing from it, because what goes on inside me is more powerful than what goes on about me. And in spiritual and in sobriety, my friends, all the wonders we seek are already inside us. All we have to do is chip away at those negatives. Chip away, chip away, and chip away. We come to the beautiful person, the beautiful sober person that's already inside us. Polish it and refine it. And please believe me, each and every one of us can have a good, sober day every day. Thank you. Thank you.